This is Our American Stories, and we love telling stories about the arts and this day in history. And the two intersect with this segment, the life of Jimmy Stewart, born on this day in history in 1908 in Indiana, Pennsylvania. It's a wonderful life? No, it's a remarkable life. Sit tight for the next hour. You'll hear about Jimmy Stewart from Jimmy, from all kinds of people who admired him, and a little bit about his background. He had Irish and Scottish ancestry and was raised as a Presbyterian. He was descended from veterans of the American Revolution, the War of 1812, and the American Civil War. And you'll see how and when Jimmy himself continued that heritage. The eldest of three children, he was expected to continue his father's business at the local hardware store, which had been in the family for three generations. Here, Jimmy Stewart himself talks about childhood and growing up in his daddy's hardware store.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful, wonderful childhood in a small town in eastern America, town of Indiana, Pennsylvania, which always confused people because Pennsylvania is a state and Indiana is also a state. Right? And when I say, when they say, where are you from? I say, Indiana, Pennsylvania. They say, well, make up your mind. Where are we? Where is it? But it's a small town. I had two sisters younger than I was. My father ran a hardware store and worked hard until he was, well, 86 years old. And he had sort of inherited the hardware store from his father. And his father inherited it from his father. So it was in the family a long time until I sort of broke up the thing, got mixed up in this acting business. But I know the hardware business. I was spent a lot of my young years there.
Wow, his father works till he's 86. His mother was an excellent pianist, but his father discouraged Stewart's request for lessons. When his father accepted a gift of an accordion from a guest, young Stewart quickly learned to play the instrument, which became a fixture offstage during his acting career. As the family grew, music continued to be an important part of the family life. Stewart got his first taste of the performing arts during his tenure as a young man at Princeton University, where he acted in shows as a member of the Triangle Club. Stewart earned a degree in architecture in 1932, but he never practiced the trade. Instead, he joined the University Players in Falmouth, Massachusetts, the summer after he graduated. Here, Jimmy Stewart talks about this time in his life.
I was going to be an architect, and I just my senior year in college, and I was just about to graduate, and a fellow came up and said, "Would you like to come up to Massachusetts? We have a stock company up there, and come up. You haven't been to the seashore, and we'll have some fun for the summer, and then you can go back to graduate school and be an architect and build buildings and do all the stuff that you're doing." I said, "Fine." So I went up, and I think this acting thing, it's like a bug. It bites you, and it bit me. And I went home and told my family that I wasn't going to graduate. I wasn't going to be an architect. I was going to do, and I had a little part in a play on Broadway, and I was going to be an actor.
Wow. Imagine hearing that. Princeton to acting school. In this clip, Stewart talks about how his family reacted to his decision to become an actor rather than an architect.
Bless their hearts, they were all very nice about it and everything. I just noticed that when I said this, everybody sort of reached for a chair, and especially my father, who never quite understood the acting business. And I think secretly he wanted me to carry on the hardware store, and I'm sorry, but I'm for his sake, I'm sorry.
Well, understanding son, understanding father, but things had to be the way they were. That same year, Stewart made his Broadway debut in the play Carrie Nation. The show didn't do well, but boy, Jimmy Stewart soon found more roles. In 1935, he landed a movie contract with MGM and headed out west. One of the film's most beloved actors, Jimmy Stewart, He's made more than 80 films since in his lifetime. He was known for his everyman quality, which made him both appealing and accessible to audiences. In his early Hollywood days, Stewart shared an apartment with Henry Fonda. The tall, lanky actor worked a number of films before co-starring with Eleanor Powell in the 1936 popular musical comedy Born to Dance. The movie featured the Cole Porter hit Easy to Love. Another career breakthrough came with Frank Capra's You Can't Take It With You. This comedy won an Academy Award for Best Picture and made Stewart a star. Here, Jimmy Stewart talks about those early days as a young actor trying to make it in Hollywood, in the big studios that he saw as perfect training grounds.
In those days, in the big studios, which is a thing that's missing now, because they were really training grounds, besides being big glamour factories, whatever you want to call them. But when you were under contract to one of the big studios in those days, you worked all the time. You had tiny little parts in big pictures, and every once in a while you would get a big part in a tiny little picture. You did tests of all kinds.
And so true it was. There were many bad things about the old studio systems, but my goodness, you got to act. And you got to act a lot. And you didn't get to choose. And again, good things about the old major league system, bad things. Great things about the old studio system, bad things. And my goodness, as we talk about music a lot, many artists are wishing major labels had more power. There was a day when artists hated the record labels. And the yin and yang between the studios and the business and the art of the arts, it's always there, that dynamic tension. When we come back, this remarkable life, Jimmy Stewart's life, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, more and more, his war service in World War II, remarkable. He comes back and continues to do remarkable work straight through to the end, one of the great icons of Hollywood and movie history, and an American icon. It's a wonderful life. It's a remarkable life. The life of Jimmy Stewart, born on this day in history. Sit back. There's so much more good stuff to come. This is Our American Stories. This day in history, Jimmy Stewart was born in 1908. He died, by the way, on July 2nd, 1997, 89 years. And multiple decades of acting performances. And where we picked up, things were just starting to get humming for young James Stewart. And Jimmy did Mr. Smith Goes to Washington in 1939, portraying a young, idealistic politician who takes on corruption. Stewart received his first Academy Award nomination for this performance. Here's the scene from that film where Stewart champions lost causes in front of Congress before passing out on the House floor.
I guess this is just another lost cause, Mr. Payne. All you people don't know about lost causes. Mr. Payne does. He said once they were the only causes worth fighting for. And he fought for them once. For the only reason any man ever fights for them. Because of just one plain, simple rule. Love thy neighbor. And in this world today full of hatred, a man who knows that one rule has a great trust. You know that rule, Mr. Payne. And I loved you for it just as my father did. And you know that you fight for the lost causes harder than for any others. Yes, you even die for them. Like a man we both knew, Mr. Payne. You think I'm licked. You all think I'm licked. Well, I'm not licked. And I'm gonna stay right here and fight for this lost cause. Even if this room gets filled with lies like these. and the tailors and all their armies come marching into this place, somebody will listen to me.
The following year, he took home Oscar Gold for The Philadelphia Story for Best Actor in a Leading Role. Stewart co-starred with Katharine Hepburn and Cary Grant, two other major movie stars in this romantic comedy. Here's a scene from The Philadelphia Story where a drunk Macaulay Connors, played by Stewart, visits C.K. Dexter Haven, played by Cary Grant, in the middle of the night.
Dexter Haven! Oh, C.K. Dexter Haven! C.K. Dexter Haven! Oh, this is where Cinderella gets off. Now, you hurry back to the ball before you turn into a pumpkin and six white mice. Goodbye. C.K. Dexter Haven. Oh, C.K. Dexter Haven!
What's up?
You are.
Let me hope it's worth it. Come on in.
I bring you greetings. Cinderella's slipper. It's called champagne. Champagne is a great leveler. It makes you my equal.
Well, I wouldn't quite say that.
Well, almost my equal.
Almost my equal. From 1941 to 46, Stewart took a break from his acting career to serve in World War II. Imagine this, folks. He gets an Oscar, and then he serves. He joined the U.S. Army Air Corps, later known as the U.S. Air Force, and rose up through the ranks to become a colonel by war's end. Stewart tried to enlist even before the Japanese launched their sneak attack on Pearl Harbor. He was rejected for being underweight. Standing over 6'3", he weighed under 160 pounds. The 32-year-old movie star went into training, eating high-caloric foods and drinking vanilla malts. In March of 1941, shortly after winning the Academy Award for Best Actor for his role in The Philadelphia Story, Stewart reported for his second physical. By the end of March, this Oscar-winning movie star was Private James Stewart, was shipped to Moffett Field at the southern end of San Francisco Bay for training with the Air Corps. In this clip, we hear from Jimmy Stewart in 1942 in a recruitment film produced by Warner Brothers aimed at young men who were thinking about joining the Air Force.
Right now, the greatest mass mobilization in the history of the world is taking place. Men from cities, towns, farms, married men and single men, brothers, sweethearts, husbands, fathers and sons, businessmen and workers from the factories, and students from colleges and high schools all over America, they're mobilizing, joining up, or having their numbers pulled out of the fishbowl. And this war we're fighting today and tomorrow and the next day until we win is a war of the air.
It was a war of the air and the ground. Too tall for the fighters, Stewart hoped to fly bombers. A little more than a month after Pearl Harbor, he earned his wings and was commissioned a second lieutenant. Wearing his Army Air Corps uniform, he served as a presenter at the Academy Awards in February and handed the Oscar for Best Actor to Gary Cooper for his role in Sergeant York. During the spring of 42, Stewart had to resist several attempts to make him a public affairs officer. Many in the Air Corps thought he'd be of greater value making appearances than flying in combat. Here is another clip from that Warner Brothers recruitment video from WW2 starring Jimmy Stewart.
Now, make no mistake about this thing, fellas. We're all going to be in this war soon, sooner than a lot of you realize. And nearly all the officers of this great Army Air Force that they're building today are going to be drawn from the ranks of you men, from high schools and colleges, those who join as aviation cadets now. Now, before I go any further, are there any questions, you know?
Hey, I'd like to make the Air Force, but I'm no brainstorm. My grades aren't exactly what they should be. I hear it's tough to get in.
Not anymore, it is.
Not anymore. After repeated requests, Stewart finally got assigned to bomber training, qualifying as a B-17 Flying Fortress pilot by February of 43. Against his wishes, he was kept stateside as a flight instructor, flying both the B-17 and the B-24 Liberator until November of 43, when then-Captain James Stewart was shipped overseas with a squadron of Liberators. Based just 100 miles north of London, he became a squadron leader in the 445th Bomb Group. Navigator Steve Kilpatrick said Stewart was, quote, a damn good commanding officer. I always had a feeling he would never ask you to do something he wouldn't do himself. In this incredible 1959 U.S. Air Force film, we enter the library in the home of Reserve Officer General Jimmy Stewart, who recalls some of the details of being a bomber pilot.
They called us truck drivers, the fighter pilots did. Well, these were the trucks that delivered the payload back in those days when the Air Force concept of strategic bombing was first being applied. And it worked pretty well. Of course, we needed fighter support in order to get through. These fighters, they were sort of like traffic cops who cleared the way for us to Berlin, Hamburg, Essen, Cologne. And sometimes it took some clearing. But whether these fighters fought aggressive actions or defensively as interceptors shooting the other fellow down before he could strike at us, their role was clear. They were fighters, and they fought.
And Stewart was a fighter, too. Again, he could have taken the easy route, used his celebrity, and he would have helped the cause, raised a lot of money. But this guy had to fight. And by the way, as we learned earlier, it was a part of his heritage. From the Revolutionary War, Stewart's fought. And by the way, you're hearing him talk about the war, and he did not do it very often, as so many of the men of that greatest generation. They just didn't talk about it. Personal accounts of Stewart sound exactly like the Stewart we know from the movies. He regularly demonstrated cool, steely nerve and a homespun dry wit. Here, an unnamed World War II veteran remembers the time he and his war buddy saw Jimmy Stewart on the streets in London.
One of my most memorable experiences of being downtown London and with my buddies, no girls, just us guys. And I looked up the street, we were getting ready to cross the street, and I looked up the street, and standing there with this gorgeous blonde was Jimmy Stewart, who was a pilot. And I said, I nudged the guys, I said, look, that's Jimmy up there. And they, we all turned and crowded and looked up the way. He had planned to come our way. He saw us gawking at him. And we looked. By the time we looked back, he was galloping across the street with this lady. I can tell you one thing about Jimmy Stewart that I know for sure. He flew many missions, wing to wing with our group. And I know he was in some very rough rides because we were in the same place. So they didn't select any special missions for Jimmy. He was right out there in the middle of it.
They didn't select any special missions for Jimmy because he wouldn't have wanted it any other way. Again, it's not just a wonderful life we're celebrating. It is a remarkable life and a humble life. And by the way, I've never heard anybody ever say, I don't like Jimmy Stewart. And by the way, if you're that person, please turn off the radio, go away, and seek some therapy. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories, the life of Jimmy Stewart, celebrated on this day in history, as always, brought to us by our friends at Hillsdale College. More after these messages. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, the life of Jimmy Stewart, born on this day in history in 1908 in Indiana, Pennsylvania, a Princeton University graduate who says no to an architecture degree and says yes to acting and then yes to war, after winning an Oscar, no less. And he says no to publicity tours and yes to getting in the air and fighting alongside fellow pilots. His plane was hit by anti-aircraft fire and nearly knocked out of the air on several occasions, but he never failed to put his bombs on target. After 20 combat missions, Stewart was promoted to major and made operations officer of the 453rd. By then, he had been awarded the Distinguished Flying Cross, 3 times received the Air Medal, and once received the Croix de Guerre from France. This latter medal was an award given by France and Belgium to individuals allied themselves and distinguished themselves with acts of heroism. He would later return home as a lieutenant colonel with 1,800 hours of flight time. Crazy. Stewart continued to play a role in the Army Air Force's reserves following World War II. On July 23, 1959, Stewart was promoted to Brigadier General. On February 20, 1966, Brigadier General Stewart flew as a non-duty observer in a B-52 on an Ark-like bombing mission during the Vietnam War. He refused the release of any publicity regarding his participation, as he did not want it treated as a stunt, but as a part of his job as an officer in the Air Force Reserves. After 27 years of service, Stewart retired from the Air Force on May 31, 1968. But after World War II, in 1946, Stewart returned to the big screen with a movie we all know, It's a Wonderful Life, directed by Frank Capra. This film tells a story about a man brought back from the verge of suicide by a guardian angel and visions of the world without him. It was a disappointment at the box office, but it became a holiday favorite over the years. Stewart reportedly considered it to be one of his favorite films. Here, Jimmy talks about getting the call from Frank Capra, asking him to do It's a Wonderful Life.
I just got a phone call one day. Capra, and he said, I have an idea for a story. Why don't you come down and I'll tell it to you. Well, I couldn't get down there quick enough, and I sat down, and he said, you're a fellow in a small town.
Mary, I know what I'm going to do tomorrow and the next day and next year and the year after that. I'm shaking the dust of this crummy little town off my feet, and I'm going to see the world.
Yeah, then you get married, and you have all these kids.
Hello, Daddy. Hello, Daddy.
And your father dies, and you have to take over the building
Four,
and loan.
3, 2, 1, bingo! We made it! Close the door, you just. We made it! Look, look, we're still in business. We still got $2 left.
And finally, you're going to kill yourself. You're going to jump off a bridge, and an angel by the name of Clarence, he comes down to help you, but he can't swim. You go down and save the... He said, this really doesn't sound very good, does it? I said, Frank, if you want me to be in a picture about a guy that wants to kill himself and an angel comes down named Clarence and he can't swim and I saved... When do we start?
What a sense, by the way, huh? Here's the scene from It's a Wonderful Life where George realizes that he's back in the real world.
Hey, what's the matter?
Now get out of here, Bert, or I'll hit you again. Get out of here.
What the Sam Hill you yelling for, George?
You... George. Bert, do you know me?
Know you? You kidding? I've been looking all over town trying to find you. I saw your car piled into that tree down there, and I thought maybe you... Hey, your mouth's bleeding. Are you sure you're all right?
What you... My mouth's bleeding, Bert! My mouse bleed! Zuzu's pedals! Zuzu! There they are! Bert! What do you know about that? Merry Christmas!
Well, Merry Christmas!
Merry! Merry! Yay! Yay! Hello, Bedford Falls!
Hello, Bedford Falls. You can't watch that enough, that movie. Jimmy Stewart tells us his favorite scene from It's a Wonderful Life before we hear that same scene in this clip. Take
well,
a listen.
I think it was the scene with the angel Clarence.
Yeah.
When we were in that little house, but when we'd just been in the water.
The bridge tender.
Yeah. And Clarence told me that he was an angel that hadn't won his wings yet. I love that.
Hey, what's with you? What'd you say just a minute ago? Why'd you want to save me?
That's what I was sent down for. I'm your guardian angel.
I wouldn't be a bit surprised.
It's ridiculous of you to think of killing yourself for money. $8,000.
Yeah, now, just things like that. Now, how do you know that?
I told you I'm your guardian angel. I know everything about you.
Well, you look about like the kind of an angel I'd get. Sort of a fallen angel, aren't you? What happened to your wings?
I haven't won my wings yet. That's why I'm an angel second class.
I don't know whether I like it very much being seen around with an angel without any wings.
Here Stewart talks about his theory of producing moments of believability as an actor.
I've sort of, over the years, I've developed a theory. I'm getting to believe that in films, what everybody is striving for is to produce moments, not a performance, not a characterization, not something that you get into the part and it's... You produce moments that create a feeling of believability to what you're doing. Now, the moments sometimes don't work. Sometimes it doesn't go... nothing happens. William Wyler has always been very famous for taking a lot of takes. And there's the story that he had had this scene with a bunch of very competent people, a very important scene in the movie, and he'd already done it 30 times. And one of them came and said, "Willie, I want to know what we're doing wrong. What do you want us to do now? I don't know." And Willie said, "No, you're doing it fine. I'm just waiting for something to happen." And that's what I mean by creating moments.
Fantastic advice to actors, and I think for human beings, actually. If we can just create moments. We try to do that here on Our American Stories as often as possible. Stewart soon starred in Harvey, 1950, a humorous movie about a man with an imaginary rabbit for a friend. But he seemed to be less interested in doing this type of lighthearted film in his later career. Stewart sought out grittier fare after the war, appearing in Anthony Mann's westerns Winchester 73 and Broken Arrow. He also became a favorite of director Alfred Hitchcock, who cast him in several classics, including The Rope, Vertigo, which is considered by many to be Hitchcock's masterpiece, and by my favorite, Rear Window, with Grace Kelly. In the 1970s, Stewart made a couple of attempts at TV. He starred on The Jimmy Stewart Show, a sitcom. He bounced around from here to there, but it was westerns that would create the resurgence of the career in film of Jimmy Stewart. And when we come back, we're going to talk about that resurgence, and we're also going to hear from other actors and stars about this great man. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories, the life of Jimmy Stewart, born on this day in history. And as always, our This Day in History is brought to us by Hillsdale College, a great place to study all the fine things in life. And if you can't get to Hillsdale, Hillsdale can get to you. Go to hillsdale.edu and check out their great online courses. More on Jimmy Stewart's life, this remarkable life, after these messages. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, the life of Jimmy Stewart celebrated for the hour he was born on this day in history. We were talking about how westerns resuscitated this great career, The Shootist. Boy, what a good movie. It turns out he was very superstitious, Stewart. He wore the same hat in every single western, and he rode the same horse for 21 years. He had a special relationship with this horse. Here, Stewart tells a story about how he told this horse to act out a scene in one of his films and how the horse, well, he just got it.
I know one night I'm coming into a town and I have a little bell on the horn of the saddle, and this sort of identifies me. And the bad guys are in the saloon, they're going to get me. And they hear the bell, and they say, here he comes. Now, what Pi had to do, the camera goes on Pi's legs and then cut to the bad guys in there and goes on as Pi is walking, and then it goes up and there's nobody on Pi, and he's walking. And they say, now, how long is it going to take you to get Pi to walk? And then, and it was 3 o'clock at night and there were lights and everything. How long is it going to get you take you to get Pi to walk down this long street all by himself? And I said, well, I'll talk to him. And I went back, and I said, Pi, now this is tough because you're a horse. But you have to walk straight down there, and I'm not going to be on you, you see. But you have to walk right straight down and clear to the other end of the set. And the fellow says, how long is it going to take? You're going to talk all night? I said, no, I think you'll do it. So that was a dolly shot, you know, with oil. So they rolled the cameras, and Pi did it the first time. It was amazing. I loved him. I loved the horse.
He loved the horse. And again, how many actors rode the same horse their entire career and had a name for the horse? The horse had a name, and he cared about that animal. Well, it was clear that Stewart loved animals, loved people. And on July 28th, 1981, Stewart went on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson to share another story about an animal that he'd loved. His golden retriever named Bo had died. And here is Jimmy with Johnny Carson telling a classic and beautiful Jimmy Stewart story.
The title of it is Bo. That's the name of the dog. He never came to me when I would call unless I had a tennis ball or he felt like it. But mostly, he didn't come at all. When he was young, he never learned to heel or sit or stay. He did things his way. Discipline was not his bag, but when you were with him, things sure didn't drag. He'd dig up a rose bush just to spite me, and when I'd grab him, he'd turn and bite me. He bit lots of folks from day to day. The delivery boy was his favorite prey. The gas man wouldn't read our meter. He said we owned a real man-eater. He set the house on fire, but the story's long to tell. Suffice to say that he survived and the house survived as well. And on evening walks, and Gloria took him, he was always first out the door. The old one and I brought up the rear because our bones were sore. And he'd charge up the street with Mom hanging on. What a beautiful pair they were. And if it was still light and the tourists were out, they created a bit of a stir. But every once in a while, he'd stop in his tracks and with a frown on his face, look around. It was just to make sure that the old one was there to follow him where he was bound. We're early to bedders in our house. I guess I'm the first to retire. And as I'd leave the room, he'd look at me and get up from his place by the fire. He knew where the tennis balls were upstairs, and I'd give him one for a while, and he'd push it under the bed with his nose, and I'd dig it out with a smile. But before very long, he'd tire of the ball, and he'd be asleep in his corner in no time at all. And there were nights when I'd feel him climb upon our bed and lie between us, and I'd pat his head. And there were nights when I'd feel this stare, and I'd wake up and he'd be sitting there, and I'd reach out to stroke his hair, and sometimes I'd feel him sigh, and I think I know the reason why. He'd wake up at night and he would have this fear of the dark, of life, of lots of things, and he'd be glad to have me near. And now he's dead. And there are nights when I think I feel him climb upon her bed and lie between us.
and I pat his head. And there are nights when I think I feel that stare, and I reach out my hand to stroke his hair, and he's not there. Oh, how I wish that wasn't so. I'll always love a dog named Bo.
And it was one of the only times I'd seen Carson move to tears. And it stunned him. And it was just a beautiful story told in sort of Dr. Seuss, simple poem form, perfect Jimmy Stewart, beginning to end. Stewart became the recipient of numerous tributes during the 80s for his career. In 84, he picked up an Honorary Academy Award for his ideals both on and off the screen. By the 90s, Stewart had largely stepped out of the public eye. He was deeply affected by the death of his bride, Gloria, in 94. The couple had been married since 1949 and had twin daughters together. He also became a father to her two sons from a previous marriage. Jimmy and Gloria Stewart were one of the Hollywood's most enduring couples, and his apparent love and commitment to her added to his reputation as an upstanding and honorable guy. In an interview in 81, Stewart and his wife Gloria were asked what the secret was to the longevity of their relationship.
I think a lot of it's luck. I mean, I know ours lasted because Jimmy is such a nice person. And if you're married to a really nice person, you really can't help but become nice yourself.
Well, now, Gloria, I think you started out that way.
No, not half as nice as he was. That was much more selfish.
Really?
No.
I'm talking. That's why it's lasted. When I say shut up, he shuts up.
I'm trying to figure out how to top that.
He affected so many people, and one of our favorites, Carol Burnett, she was affected by Jimmy Stewart. Here she is talking about Jimmy's acting in It's a Wonderful Life as one of her favorite scenes of all time.
I think it's one of the finest pieces of work of acting anyone has ever done on the screen. That moment at that bar, it's indelible in my mind. He realizes that he has lost everything. The money is missing. It's Christmas Eve, and he sits there and starts to cry. He is so in tune with that character and with that writing that he and George Bailey are one.
Dear Father in Heaven, I'm not a praying man, but if you're up there and you can hear me, show me the way. I'm at the end of my rope. Show me the way, oh God.
Are you all right, George? Want somebody to take you home, huh?
We played you Jimmy Stewart's poem about the death of his beloved dog, Bo. Here, Jimmy Stewart recites his poem, Hotel in Hunin, for Johnny Carson on May 2nd, 1983.
Now, this is the hotel in Hunin. And it goes like that. The top step in the hotel in Hunin is mean. like the devil is mean. And it lies at the top of the other steps. So quiet, so still, so serene. But this top step has something quite special, a very ingenious device. It's half an inch higher than the other steps, a whole inch to be more precise. And it uses this inch as a weapon, the guests of the place to harass. For when you reach the third floor of that hotel in Hunin, the top step trips you right on your ass. I've had my share of knocks on the head. I've felt enemy gunfire in war. But if you want my opinion of what's really bad, I'd be glad to give you the score. Of all the degrading, inhuman, mean things that I in my life have yet seen, the gross, most despicable one of them all is the top step in the hotel in Hunan.
He died on July 2nd, 1997, but on this day in history he was born. While he may be gone, his movies have lived on and inspired countless others. His warmth, his good humor, you just heard it. And my goodness, his easy charm and his honor. It's all there, and it left a lasting impression on America forever. Jimmy Stewart. This is Our American Stories, and you're listening to Aaron Copland's Fanfare for the Common Man, a tribute to those who serve because it's National Police Week, a week to honor the fallen, a week to honor those who gave their last full measure of devotion to their communities, to their country. National Police Week centers around a memorial service that began in 1982 as a gathering in Washington, D.C.'s Senate Park, with approximately 120 survivors and supporters of law enforcement. Decades later, tens of thousands attend it annually. For the hour, we'll celebrate the fallen's lives with their stories and tributes to them. The first story is of Ashley Gwinden, a 28-year-old police officer who lost her life on her very first shift on February 27th, 2016, in Prince William County, Virginia. Earlier this morning, we interviewed her mentor and counselor, Chris Bonner, professor at Emory-Riddle Aeronautical University, about Ashley. Chris is a veteran of law enforcement himself, spending 28 years as a special agent with the FBI, and is now a reserve deputy sheriff in his community. He first told us how he met Ashley.
I teach courses in Homeland Security and Security Studies to include terrorism, intelligence, and criminal justice. Ashley was one of my first students that I taught at Embry-Riddle, and she was also I learned she was a reservist in the United States Marine Corps, so she attracted a lot of attention, my attention, you know, because of her background and the career field she chose. After class, a lot of my students, they'll come to my office and we'll talk about my prior law enforcement career. And sometimes I suggest to them that it's perhaps a career path that they should entertain. Ashley was one of them. She identified early on that she wanted to go into law enforcement.
Ashley wanted to go into forensics and crime scene investigations. She entered the graduate program in forensic science at George Washington University and subsequently took an internship and then a job at Prince William County Crime Scene Unit, and later found her calling as a police officer, and then came her first day. And then came the news that nobody wants to hear, no family member, no friend, no nobody. And we hear from Chris, her mentor, and how he learned of what happened, sadly and tragically, to his mentee.
Then one sad day, a couple months ago, I go online and I see a police officer was killed in the line of duty. And, and as I said before, I take these things personally. It really hits home. I've lost friends that were killed in the line of duty who are law enforcement officers. And then I was horrified to see that it was Ashley Gwinden. And it was me even more horrified and saddened to see that it was her first day on the job. She did not even complete her first shift. When she responded to a domestic violence call, and from talking to my colleagues and law enforcement partners, is sometimes one of the worst calls you can get involved in, because they're highly emotionally charged. Usually physical abuse occurs, and somebody's going to jail that night. So Ashley and her training officer and another officer appear at this house, and upon approaching the house, the subject opened the door, met them with a rifle, and started shooting. Ashley and the two other officers went down, and I learned that Ashley refused or delayed medical attention, saying that her partners needed it more than she did. I think back on these things and the sorrow and the tragedy that unfolded that day, both the victim of the domestic violence and the police officers, and it's just tragic. I was just crestfallen when I heard that. She'll ever be forever remembered as a hero and a role model, especially the females. Females are underrepresented in law enforcement, and I think Ashley Gwinden should be considered a beacon, a bright light, as an example to everyone of the best of young people and what they could become.
Well, indeed, only 11% of law enforcement is female. Ashley, again, was one of them. We asked Chris, was she one of the few folks he mentored, or was she one of a kind?
She was one of a few that became one of a kind. She was one of the few because of her her background, being a Marine Corps reservist, and the fact that you know, she was a female. Usually, the students of mine that wanted to go into law enforcement are generally, you know, the male students, and that set her aside and apart. And you know, because of her background, she lost her father. She was raised by her mother. I kind of took special interest in her, in wanting her to realize her career. So mentorship is a very, very important part of my job as a university professor, to help these students identify a career path and then help them realize that dream. I'm only too happy to help. I think it's part of, it is part of my job, and Ashley was an individual that I wanted to make sure that she attained the goal that she set. And I feel like I helped her do that, but then tragically, she's not with us anymore. However, she still continues to be a mentor. She can forever be a mentor in the hearts of law enforcement officers as an example of the best.
And indeed, that domestic dispute case, there was a telephone voice and a call from a wife, a woman afraid of her husband. And she said, he's going to kill me. And when Ashley and her crew got there, that woman was dead. And then that guy wanted to kill cops, and he did. So always remember, these cops, when they respond to these calls, they never know what's going to happen. Ashley Gwinden, just one of others, we'll cover here on our tribute, National Police Week, to fallen heroes. More after these messages. This is Our American Stories, National Police Week. A week to honor the fallen. A week to honor those who gave their last full measure of devotion to their communities and their country. And we're talking about Ashley Gwinden, who was tragically killed on her first shift on February 27, 2016, in Prince William County, Virginia, answering the domestic dispute call. Something you'd think would just be quite ordinary. Only it didn't end well. And we were talking to her mentor this morning, and Chris Bonner, a former FBI agent, and again, her mentor and her teacher, we spoke with. And for almost any of us, anytime we do something brand new for the first time, it's nerve-wracking. And that's especially got to be the case for police officers on their first call, answering that first call. We asked Chris Bonner how Ashley must have felt going into this, her first and her final shift.
Of course, you're a bundle of nerves. You're hoping that you're going to do the right thing. You have a field training officer with you, and especially women. Because women in law enforcement, there's still that male dominance that kind of says, oh, well, you know, she needs help. She's a woman. She's not going to execute to the standards of training. And I'm sure all that's going through her mind, especially her first call, that she wanted to do well. She was going to do well. She was going to apply her training, her intelligence on that. And I'm sure that was going through her mind going up to that door the first time you make an arrest, not knowing what's on the other side of the door. It's quite intimidating. And it's an adrenaline rush, an adrenaline flow. And I'm sure all these emotions were going on in her head. But then again, when a police officer approaches that front door, you get that tunnel vision, and you become so focused. You know, it's just a it's a lot of things going on where the general public sees or reads about police encounters and shootings and such, and then they analyze it like the talking heads on TV do. Well, they have the vision of hindsight. They have the time to assess and analyze what's going on. Not a police officer. A police officer has to react in a split second in life and death situations, hoping that the training will kick in and the right thing will be done. It's a lot to process, especially in the mind of somebody on the first day on the job.
We asked Chris what it was like going to Ashley's funeral and the all too many law enforcement funerals he's been to.
When you go to, we call them cop funerals or police funerals, you see the long lines of police officers standing at attention, stone-faced and stoic. But inside, a full range of emotions are taking place, to include angst, anxiety, sorrow, grief. And every time a police officer is killed in the line of duty, law enforcement officer pays the ultimate sacrifice, a little bit of us dies with that officer inside of us.
MB Riddle Aeronautical University, where Chris is a professor, has permanently placed a plaque on the campus in honor of Ashley, a plaque that contains one of her favorite sayings: live for something rather than die for nothing. Chris once told a reporter, quote, "Sometimes I feel like I kind of talked her into this career. Do I feel a sense of responsibility? I don't know." If Chris does have any responsibility for talking her into this career, he should be proud of it. Proud of who she was and his role in it. And this next gentleman we're about to hear from said it was right. It was meant to be. He said it was time to go home. God called them home. Let's take a listen to the then Memphis Police Director, Tony Armstrong, eulogizing police officer and Marine veteran of the Iraq War, Sean Bolton, who was shot and killed during a traffic stop that many of us civilians see as routine and a nuisance. But for cops, well, that's not quite how they see it. Let's take a listen.
The citizens in this great city slept very well knowing that Sean was on patrol. On August the 1st, God arranged for Sean to patrol the neighborhood. God arranged that meeting. People were asleep in their beds. Sean was doing what I would love for in you, the man that we do. Patrol your neighborhood. You demand that when we see something that just does not feel right to us, that our training, our experience tells us it's not right, you demand that we investigate. And that's exactly what Sean did. Sean encountered an individual and it's basically said that that individual took his life, but that's not totally true. It was time for Sean to go home. God called Sean home. At the conclusion of our shifts, after we've done our time, our officers get on the radio. Taylor, the dispatcher, it's time for me to signal C. And basically what that is just telling the dispatcher, I've completed my shift. I've answered every call. I've done my absolute best on this day. My time is up. I've done my job. Take me out of service. I'm no longer available for calls. It's time for me to go home. And Sean made it home. God embraced Sean. And I want to say to Sean now what we should have said to him a long time ago. Thank you. Thank you for your service to this country. And thank you for making the ultimate sacrifice to this city. When Sean made it home, God embraced him. God looked at him and said, Sean, all lives matter.
All lives matter. And some time ago, I wrote a column called Cops' Lives Matter. And some of the things I pointed out in that column were the remarkable number of lives cops save and have saved. And in New York City, for instance, in the 1990s, 2,200 people a year were getting killed, murdered. And it was 290 the year before last. That's amazing. I wrote, the majority of lives saved were actually black, because the overwhelming majority of murder victims in the city are black. Do the math. Tens of thousands of black lives saved in the past two decades by cops, black and white, in New York. By the way, the mayor couldn't manage to bring that up when there had been a terrible and tragic and fatal shooting and a couple of things that cops had done in New York that weren't particularly good. And by the way, there were bad cops. But he didn't give credit to all the good cops and never bothered. Why are you killing us? A protester recently asked Sergeant Harry Dilworth, a black cop from Ferguson. Dilworth told a New York Times reporter that he responded by naming three names and asked the protester if he had heard of any of them. The protester hadn't. Dilworth told him they were black men recently killed in St. Louis by other black men. We're not killing you. You're killing yourselves, the African-American man told the other African-American man. And that's why so many cops are upset. Yeah, there are bad cops. We know that. And we've got to out them. And cops know this. And there's got to be more transparency. But they're being blamed, I wrote, for problems they didn't cause. And because not one of those leaders tried to exhibit any sympathy for cops at that time, then the world and the media was coming down on law enforcement in general. And by the way, the media could have asked us to imagine what it would like to be the spouse of a cop working in New York City or Detroit or Los Angeles or some of the tough crime areas in white or rural America. Most Americans, I wrote, have no idea what it's like to be a cop, what cops worry about, what their families worry about, how easily a simple disturbance can get out of hand, how dangerous a domestic violence case can turn, how tragically even a routine traffic stop can end. What every cop I know tells me is this. What they worry about most is doing no harm to innocent people and getting home safe each night and getting their partners home safe too. And what they tell me over and over is this. What throws everything upside down is when a person being questioned or stopped doesn't comply with the instructions of police. Or worse, when he or she resists, that's when bad things happen. It doesn't matter what the infraction is. When a citizen resists arrests, it's a danger signal. And that's when everything heads south. Black Lives Matter, we close the column out with, but cops' lives matter too. And the two both need to be understood. This is Lee Habib. More in this celebration and honoring of fallen cops, National Police Week. More after these messages. is Our American Stories, and it's National Police Week, a week to honor the fallen, and again, to honor those who gave their last measure of devotion to their communities and paid the ultimate price with their lives. Our next story is that of Kentucky State Trooper Cameron Ponder. On September 13th, 2015, he was conducting a routine traffic stop. It was 10 p.m., and after about 10 minutes, the vehicle sped off, leading Trooper Ponder on a high-speed chase. Let's listen to the harrowing audio of the police radio communications on what happened next.
His car is smoking. He's slowing down. We're down to 76 right now.
10-4.
I think he's stopping here at the 49.
10-4, 35, you copy?
He's off again. He's got a blown front left tire. I tried pinning him in, and he's trying to go still.
10-4.
Permission to pit?
Yeah.
He's done. He don't have a tire.
10-4.
Shots fired. Shots fired. Shots. I'm hit. I need assistance. Passing out.
35, did you copy?
Mayfield, repeat.
Shots fired at 35. He's been hit. He's passing out.
And by the way, that's not a CSI series, folks. That's what it sounds like. Trooper Ponder died as a result of his wounds, including a gunshot wound to the face. One man who knew Trooper Cameron Ponder was Agent Garrick Zink Kazinkowitz, himself of the United States Border Patrol. He wanted Cam, his best friend of 20 years, to be the best man at his wedding. Here's what Zink later wrote in remembrance of his friend. And I'm going to read. Cam, words can't explain what you meant to me. It seems like just yesterday we were dominating the playing fields together. Buddy, what I'd do to get back to those days. There are so many good times we shared together when we were growing up. Great stories. Memories I'll carry with me forever, my friend. It's been a little more than a year since you've left San Diego now. I remember helping you get all your stuff packed as you were moving out of my house. It was a tough day for both of us. We both knew it would be a long time before we would see each other again. Neither one of us said anything, just a hug, handshake, and a take care, my friend. I remember I made a call to you in mid-February of 2015. It was one of the most exciting calls of my life. Cam, I said as you picked up. Your boy's getting hitched. Man, you were so excited for me, it even took me by surprise. Given the fact that you had just graduated the Kentucky State Police Academy, I knew it would be tough for you to get time off and attend. But I asked anyway. Cam, I want you to be my best man, I asked. Buddy, I know it killed you that you couldn't be there. It meant the world to me, though, to see how happy you were for me. And I appreciate that more than anything. You were there in spirit, and that's all I cared about, my friend. It's funny to me how as we get older, we never grew apart. We didn't have to speak to each other once a week. We'd go months without talking, and somehow, when we spoke, it's like we never missed a beat. We'd just pick right up where we left off the last time. You know? I'm going to miss that, my friend. Here we are now, and my one regret at this moment is that I didn't call you sooner. I never got a chance to ask you how life as an LEO was, which is shorthand for law enforcement officer. I never got a chance to say congratulations on your engagement. I never got a chance to say thank you for our friendship, for the memories, and for your service. And for that, I am truly sorry, Cam. Your memory will live on forever with me, Cam. You touched so many people's lives in a positive way. Your service to keep the public safe will never be forgotten. You made the ultimate sacrifice. And as much pain as I'm in, it comforts me to know that you are in a better place. You'll forever have a place in my heart. And it's been an honor being by your side all these years. I'm coming home, buddy. We will be united one last time. Beautiful. You don't hear men writing to each other like that enough. And on Our American Stories, we're happy to bring that to you. It's an honor. The next story, Susan Farrell, a Des Moines police officer. Susan had been a veteran for over 11 years. She was hit in her cruiser and killed in a head-on collision by a drunk driver. At her emotional funeral, Police Chief Dana Wingert asked all the first responders to stand. And then he said this.
So why get in this business? If this is how it ends, if this is what it's all about, why sign on? Regardless of whether you're fighting fires, fighting crime, or providing medical care to save lives, you sign on because you know that there are people that depend on you. You sign on because you know that you're making a difference and it would be chaos without you. You sign on for the personal satisfaction that you're able to bring home from the job that only someone that fills your role can understand. You sign on because it's a calling and you truly care about the welfare of others. Don't ever for a second forget why you signed on. To the family members, I'd like you to turn around. I'd like you to turn around and take this all in. And don't just look at the sheer numbers, look into their eyes. They sign on because you know that there are people like this in this room that will always be there for you. It is who we are. It is what we do. Brothers and sisters, there's nothing quite like it. And Officer Susan Farrell will always be a part of this family. They didn't make it. Those are the words that we'll never forget. But I stand here before you today to argue that statement. These are nothing more than words because Officer Susan Farrell and Officer Carlos Puente Morales did make it. And now they sit in God's house and they watch over us and they guide us and they will for all of our days. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called children of God.
Blessed are the peacemakers. And again, so often in the media, the focus is on the bad few. And sometimes the exceptional men and women of courage. But here in Our American Stories, we want to honor the vast majority of cops trying to do their job under difficult circumstances. We will always talk about holding our nation's cops to the highest standard. And the best of the breed want that. And they don't like bad cops in their midst. They don't. I know too many. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. For the hour, National Police Week. Again, you heard about Susan Farrell. My goodness, you heard the story of Ashley Gwinden. And you're going to hear some more stories on the other side of this break. And I think what's so irritating to so many officers of the law is that cops have driven crime rates to epic lows in this country. And yet 50% of Americans think crime is on the rise. And that's because the media just wants to beat us up with the latest crime statistics. And of course, when there's a bad cop story, they get so excited. And it's just, well, it's just irritating. And worse, it's a morale downer to all the men and women who've done so much good. And it would be once in a while, it would be nice to celebrate and honor cops. And that's what we're doing here. National Police Week. Our American Stories. More after these messages. This is Our American Stories, and it's National Police Week. And we're spending an hour today, and we've spent quite a bit of time this week, honoring the men and women in blue who've fallen, protecting us from chaos. And we learned right away in that first story about young Ashley Gwinden. On her very first call, a simple, you would think, domestic dispute case, a woman screaming for help about a husband she said was trying to kill her. And by the way, they get those calls all the time, and more often than not, the husband isn't actually trying to kill her at the time, the spouse. Harm her, possibly. But in this particular occasion, the husband was trying to kill her, and he killed her. And when the cops arrived, they arrived to a crime scene. A dead body and a man with a gun who is now looking to kill more people. And cops in particular. And he didn't hesitate. And he gunned down Ashley Gwinden on her first and her last tour of duty. And again, what we try to emphasize here in Our American Stories is that when cops go into these situations, they don't know what's going to happen. An ordinary traffic stop. And having known so many friends whose family served when I was living in northern New Jersey in the NYPD, and I would watch Carl Bazin's brothers strap up, put on that gun, and one of them worked in transit in the subways back when that was not a particularly safe beat. And what he wanted to do was make it safe for the women, the waitresses particularly. He always said, that waitress who's going down there at 1 a.m., that's every bad guy's dream, to get her, and I'm not going to let him. And there are a lot of things Carl's brother could have done in his life, but that's what he wanted to do. And watching him get to work each day, putting that gun on and being plain clothes, you knew he could not come back. That was a strong chance of that. And he did it anyway. And that's always the image I have in my head, is Carl Bazin's family, so many of them, almost all of them dedicated to law enforcement, from the dad to the brothers to Carl and the FBI, and a special shout out to you, buddy, because a lot of things you could have done with your law degree at University of Virginia, and serving in counterterrorism in New York City, going around the world, dropping in Yemen, and all these crazy places you've dropped into in Afghanistan and Iraq. God bless, Godspeed. And now let's get to our final story. And it's the story of Marine veteran, Massachusetts State Trooper Thomas Clardy. The day, March 16th, 2016, Thomas was pulling an extra shift before his regularly scheduled duty day to help provide for his seven children. It was noon, and he had just pulled over a Chevy Tahoe. What happened next happened fast. A Nissan Maxima traveling in the outermost lane suddenly veered across three lanes of traffic, almost as if it was intentional. It didn't slow down. It didn't deviate. It just sped straight at Trooper Clardy, and then it slammed into his cruiser. The incredible force of the impact pushed he and his police cruiser into the Tahoe, and all three of them landed in the grass off the highway. Though the ambulance arrived quickly, State Trooper Clardy was declared dead on arrival. At his funeral outside St. Michael's Catholic Church, the Massachusetts State pipes and drums honored their fallen. While 1,120 state troopers stood at attention, how do we know that's the number exactly? Well, because his young daughter counted every single trooper as they passed. That's how we know. Perhaps more than anyone, Trooper Clardy will live in the hearts of his children, each of whom wrote a note to be read at his funeral by his friend, retired police sergeant Al Toney. You can hear him struggling to get through these heart-rending letters.
Daddy, I love you. Didn't care. I love the fact that you didn't care what other people thought. I loved how funny you were. I loved all the stories and jokes. I love you, Dad, Emma. Daddy, I remember even though you were running late to work, you always had time to say goodbye. And you always had time to play a game. We always had time to play a game with you. I love you, Daddy. I love Eva. Daddy, I loved that you cared whatever, you didn't care what anyone thought about you. You would always make us happy. You would always make sure that we had everything we needed. I love you and miss you. Love, Gabriella. Daddy, my favorite thing with my dad was snuggling with him, hugs and kisses. Love, Noah. Lily, my dad was a great guy. I loved him for many things. I loved how he always said to me, I can't wait till I get to work. And tell the guys I work with about the most beautiful girl in the world.
But Sergeant Tony saved the best one for last, from Trooper Clardy's 17-year-old son, Tyler, who, much to all the funeral's delight, brought a laugh and a smile to everyone's face as he divulged the secret moments he long shared and treasured with his dad.
Tyler says to me, in 2007, he was 9 years old. His father came, they had a birthday party for him. His father came to him, and father says, come with me, son. His father took him out. He says, where are we going? They went to the show. Pulled up to the theater and went to the show. Tom turned to Tyler and he said, it's about time, son. I'm going to take you to your first R-rated movie. So, excuse me, go ahead. The summer before, Tyler states also that the summer before his senior year in high school, he was turned 17. He says his dad came home. It was like any other day. His dad came home, and his dad said, son, come with me. They went out to the backyard, made a fire in the fire pit. Tom put two chairs around the fire pit. Tyler says they sat there for 3 hours. They made hot dogs and hamburgers, just the two of them. And Tom talked to Tyler about life. Not only did Tom tell Tyler about life, Tom told Tyler what he expected of him in life. That's a father. That's a father that cares.
Trooper Clardy, remembered by his kids, remembered by his colleagues. And we're going to leave this hour with another reading. The Thin Blue Line really is a fraternity of sorts, a brotherhood that doesn't require kinship, but is born by shared sacrifice. Here is an officer sharing a poem for his fallen brothers. Here is Chad Miner.
Hello, my name is Chad Miner. I work for the police department in Powell, Wyoming. In 2011, we lost one of our patrol sergeants to an off-duty accident. During that time, dispatcher Jesse Borcher forwarded a poem to me titled The Final Inspection. I would like to share that poem with you today. The policeman stood and faced his God, which must always come to pass. He hoped his shoes were shiny, just as brightly as his brass. Step forward now, policeman, how shall I deal with you? Have you always turned the other cheek? To my church have you been true? The policeman squared his shoulders and said, No, Lord, I guess I ain't. Because those of us who carry badges can't always be a saint. I've had to work most Sundays, and at times my talk was rough. And sometimes I've been violent, because the streets are awfully tough. But I never took a penny that wasn't mine to keep, though I worked a lot of overtime when the bills got just too steep. And I never passed a cry for help, though at times I shook with fear. And sometimes, God forgive me, I've wept unmanly tears. I know I don't deserve a place among the people here. They never wanted me around, except to calm their fear. If you've a place for me here, Lord, it needn't be so grand. I never expected or had too much, but if you don't, I'll understand. There was silence all around the throne, where the saints had often trod, as policemen waited quietly for the judgment of his God. Step forward now, policeman. You've borne your burdens well. Come walk a beat on heaven's streets. You've done your time in hell. The author of this poem is unknown. We would like to extend our thoughts and prayers to the families who have lost loved ones in the line of duty, and also to those families that currently share their loved ones in the line of duty. May God bless you.
This is Our American Stories, celebrating National Police Week. You heard the stories of Ashley Gwinden, of Cameron Ponder, of Susan Farrell and Thomas Clardy. Des Moines, Massachusetts, Northern Virginia, Kentucky, all over this great country, the men and women in blue serving us, putting themselves in harm's way, protecting us from chaos and evil. Catch this on OurAmericanNetwork.org when you can. Catch it starting tonight. Tomorrow, we'll keep it up there. Send the link to everyone you know. Anyone who served, anyone who cares and respects about people who serve. Great work, team. Have a blessed night.